Welcome to Community Conversation on WSKG. This is part three in a series of programs exploring early childhood education and child care in this state. I'm your host, Charles Compton, and we're in front of a live audience at SUNY Broome Community College in Binghamton. Later, we'll be taking their questions and comments. New York is building a pre-K system. Funds have been allocated, and school districts are customizing programs for their communities. We'll talk about learning and teaching soon, but first, State Assemblywoman Donna Lepardo is here to talk about Albany's role. She chairs the New York House Committee on Families and Children. Assemblywoman, welcome to Community Conversation.
Nice to be here. Thanks for inviting me.
When we discussed pre-kindergarten education last month on Community Conversation, there was no state budget, but now New York has one. That new budget includes $365 million for four-year-old pre-K and $30 million to expand pre-K for three-year-olds and in high-needs districts. Given demand for more early childhood education in New York, is that going to be enough or is it just a start?
Well, it's been a push that's been on for quite some time. The Assembly has been really the champion for universal pre-K for well over a decade. And to try to get the financial commitment that is needed has always been the challenge. So we certainly welcome to have more resources, but this is a very good start. We did a large expansion last year in New York City, and now we're trying to get more into the upstate region. So one of the problems we have is that not only is pre-K not mandatory or required, kindergarten is not mandatory or required in New York State either. In fact, some school districts don't even carry kindergarten. So when you take that into consideration, we are trying very hard to get those programs up to speed. But then there's a trust factor. You have to also take into consideration that most pre-K is dependent on state funding. So schools in my area, for example, they offer half-day pre-K. They may be reluctant to expand that because they may set up an expectation where the funds may not be available. So it's very important. We're putting as much resource as we can into it, but to answer your question, no, it's not enough.
Consistent funding is a real issue, not only having it this year, but being able to look 5 years down the road as well. And some states have dealt with that problem by incorporating pre-K education into the education budget. It's a little more predictable. I know they don't do that here in New York. Is there a movement afoot to make that happen here?
We're interested in developing the entire pipeline, the entire education pipeline. We're looking at making investments in early education, even before pre-K, adequately investing in pre-K all the way through after-school programs, helping children prepare for careers after the K-12 system. So it's enormously expensive, but it is extremely valuable, and the return on the investment helps to pay for it because you have children who are less apt to use health services, mental health services, incarceration services to do with the criminal justice system, impacts on all of those levels. So it's sometimes difficult to prove the money you save, but I think everyone knows that children who are prepared for school are prepared to be healthier, more productive citizens.
It's not just a question of funding, too. I mean, essentially, can more be done to enhance the training of caregivers, to require more training, to provide more training opportunities by the state?
There's no question about it. Some of the folks, in fact, many of the people who are entrusted with children, whether in child care or in pre-K settings, are dramatically underpaid. And given the education that they go through and given the trust that they are given, they should be paid a much better salary as far as I'm concerned. Raising that profession up to the status it deserves will improve the outcomes and improve the entire educational pipeline, as I mentioned before. So no question around it. A lot of us have been talking about this for a very long time. It's hard for this to become what we like to refer to as everybody's problem. When children aren't prepared for school, in a variety of ways, society pays the cost, and business in particular, businesses are starting to pay attention. Why? Because they're having a hard time getting employees who are prepared for the workforce. So we're having more businesses come around saying, how can we help with this entire conversation?
So this isn't just an education issue, it's an economic issue as well. I mean, I guess it's a lot of different kinds of issues.
Well, Absolutely. When I became chair of the committee, I immediately tried to bring into the conversation economic development professionals, planners, business community members, foundations, to say, really, this is everyone's concern, and we all need to be paying attention, but also helping to pay for a way of developing the system.
This is Community Conversation on WSKG. I'm Charles Compton, speaking with Assemblywoman Donna Lepardo. If anyone in the audience wants to ask a question, we have a microphone. Just raise your hand, and our mic person will walk over and hand it to you as well. What about setting some standards for pay? I mean, is that the role the state could take on so that, I mean, you can't really set a minimum wage for preschool teachers, can you?
Well, we most certainly can, as far as I'm concerned. I mean, we're arguing about having a living minimum wage in general. I mean, right now the minimum wage is really quite low for people who are trying to live on that wage. So what I'm referring to is elevating the profession. And when the profession is elevated and people are prepared to pay folks what they are worth in the job they're doing, then everything around it has to begin to match up. So the cost of childcare is affordable, and where it can be subsidized, we subsidize it so that providers can stay in business and people who need the services will have it available. Many other countries get this right. The United States is really not a very stellar showing as far as childcare goes.
Why do you think that is?
We could speculate on that, and I can't really say definitively. There are, obviously a lot of reasons. It's not often a high priority, certainly for up to this point, for businesses. I'll give you one example. Our Regional Economic Development Council, we do spend a lot of money promoting business and bringing new businesses in. One of our goals would be that there would be certain expectations when businesses come that they provide childcare. It has to be something people think about as part of a normal, healthy society, that children have a safe and productive early learning experience. And why we don't value that, it's hard to say.
It's not the kind of thing you can legislate either. You're talking about a cultural change, aren't you?
It's a very big cultural change. But we look to our colleagues and friends over in other countries, and you see the value that is placed on that time period in a child's life. You really have to envy the concern that they have. And it certainly is a cultural societal bias that we as legislators are trying to correct in the work we do.
What are the politics here? I mean, who would stand in the way of enhancing early childhood education or child care for pre-kindergarten kids?
I'm not sure that anyone is actively standing in the way. I really think it's an educational process. People have not focused on it being everyone's problem very much. It has been mostly viewed as human service concern or concern for families with young children. It's their problem. Many of us are trying to broaden that dialogue and educate the community on the impacts down the road if we don't get this part right.
And I've heard that a couple of times as we've done this series of parents, older people calling and saying, I took care of my kids, it's your job to take care of yours, why should I take responsibility for it? It's that kind of thinking that you're talking about trying to change.
We have a lot of two-person families where both husband, wife, spouses are both working, and they want to be able to leave their children in a safe and educationally enriching setting. And it's those quality concerns that are something that we're trying to elevate. It's not just a babysitting experience. This is the vital years, which you're going to be hearing about next, where those brains are formed. And if we don't enrich it on the front end, honestly, we are seeing the expense at the other end.
Donna, we have a question from our audience. Go ahead.
Chris from Binghamton. I'm a mature worker and have been involved in the early childhood education process in this community since the 70s. And recognizing that more and more moms and dads have to work to put food on the table, what can be done so that early childhood educators' pay scale is so that they can band together or do something so that we're still not waiting for more and more pay. Over the time I've been in education, the salaries for lead teachers in this area seem to have remained fairly flat. I can speak to that as having been employed in several different daycare centers. And for years, we've been hearing the conversation that we must pay our teachers more, but how long should teachers wait? Or have we made it so now people that want to teach will go to other industries and make $11 an hour as a greeter rather than $8 an hour as a lead teacher?
Yeah, no, I understand what you're saying. There are obviously different places in the community where folks like this are employed. So whether it be in the school district, you have one set of circumstances. Whether you're in a private daycare provider, it's a different circumstance. I know that there has been a very active union movement through CSEA to unionize certain workers in this field. We're also very actively pursuing a change in what's called the market rate survey so that people who provide services, childcare services, specifically in our community, are paid what it's worth. We have a certain problem because we are grouped into a bunch of rural communities, rural counties. So we want to look at the way childcare is priced, and the more money we can get to providers, the more they can pass that along to their employees. So different settings, different circumstances, all the same general concern that this work isn't as valued as it needs to be. And many of us are very committed to changing that. We see how important that work is. And it's a shame that it's not as valued.
We have different paid family leave proposals that are on the table this year. The governor says he supports some kind of paid leave, but he's getting pressure to actually push for something specific. That's another big thing that families need. I mean, are we going to have to set priorities, paid family leave, early childhood education, or somehow or another have it all?
Yes. Yes, we most definitely have to prioritize these matters. This assembly has already passed a paid family leave bill. Of course, Senator Gillibrand is very, very much out in front of this at the federal level. And I know the governor is concerned, he's interested in speaking with us more about that. We have to persuade our colleagues in the state Senate. Obviously, business community is concerned about the cost, and we need to try to come up with a way to make this work, and perhaps a small payroll tax might be the way to do it. We're not sure. We want to have an open dialogue with all parties so that everyone feels committed to this and that it's not an undue burden.
State Assemblywoman Donna Lepardo, thank you so much for coming in and taking our questions and comments.
You're welcome.
Donna Lepardo represents Binghamton and Vestal in the New York State Assembly. We'll be back in a minute with Michael Goldstein. He works in a baby lab. We'll find out what that's all about. Stay tuned.
Looking for ways to get the kids in your life up and moving? Check out WSKG's Kids in Motion videos online. They're fun and simple movement activities, easy to do at home or in a classroom.
Today, we're going to play a game called Mystery Bag Fitness. Today, we are going to learn action words in Spanish. And we're going to play a game today called Twizzle.
Live healthy!
Learn and move with Kids in Motion videos online at WSKG.org. Click Educate, then Kids-Motion.
WSKG makes a difference in your world, and your $5 or $10 a month could make a world of difference to WSKG. Enroll to contribute monthly from your bank account or credit card, then you'll always know you're a supporter. You can change the arrangement anytime. Become an ongoing monthly sustainer before April 23rd, and you'll be entered into a drawing for an iPad Air. Sign up today at WSKG.org, and thank you.
Welcome back to Community Conversation on WSKG from SUNY Broome. We're talking about early childhood education and how kids learn. With me now is Michael Goldstein of Cornell University. He's a professor of psychology and runs the Cornell Baby Lab. Welcome to WSKG.
Hi, thanks.
First, you got to tell us, what is a baby lab? It sounds very scientific. Do you study infant behavior the way you would study mice and monkeys?
Sometimes. The lab's actually divided into two. Half of it, we look at how infants learn to talk and how parents learn to parent. And the other half, we look at how birds learn to sing.
So where do you get your subjects?
Well, with the birds, we can breed in the lab. It's very convenient. They're a zebra finch. The parents, we don't really take the same approach. We go out into the community, and we go to the farmer's market. We advertise on Craigslist. We have a website where people can sign up, and we have letters that parents, when they have babies at the Cayuga Medical Center, can return a card to let us know that they're interested.
That's got to be a little tough in kind of a closed population like Ithaca. You want to make sure you have a kind of a diverse population, I'm guessing.
You got it. It's our biggest challenge. So we have a mobile laboratory that will take up to Syracuse sometimes, and we will run studies in reading rooms of public libraries where we can get to a much more diverse sort of socioeconomic sample.
Now, when you wrote to us, you sent us a prepared statement, and you said that in the lab we study parents and infants as a system.
Yes.
What are you talking about there, a system?
Sure. This sounds sort of like a strange thing to say, but as long as there have been babies, there have been parents. We are a very slow-developing species, and one of the characteristics of our brains, of our nervous system, is that we use information from the ubiquitous social environment. Because we're slow developers, you know, if your parents aren't around, you don't have to worry about learning language because you're not going to eat. Okay, you're not going to stay warm. So our nervous systems expect certain kinds of stimulation from certain kinds of social contexts at certain times. And so if you just study babies, you miss sort of the ubiquitous sort of social context in which they've evolved to learn from. So we study how parents react to babies and how babies react to parents together.
Interesting. Something that you said was that babies learn more from a remote control car that responds to their babbling than they would to an unfamiliar, an adult, a stranger. Why is that the case?
Sure. So one of our sort of major research programs is looking at how babies first learn to produce the sounds of their language. And one of the things we found, and this is actually based on our birdsong work, is that babies use the reactions of adults that are contingent on their babbles to figure out what sounds they ought to be producing. And so if I'm babbling away and I'm making noise and you react to that contingently with some noise of your own, I'm more likely to learn the patterns in your speech if they occur just after I make some babbling sounds. So we decided to really test that with a completely unfamiliar social interaction partner that still had the timing component. So we used a remote-controlled car. And babies learn from that even better, because we could really ramp the timing up to make the, there was a little speaker on the car, to make the speech patterns from the car contingent on the baby's babbles.
What fascinates me about this is that somehow or another, a baby knows how to learn from this interaction. They come, what, pre-wired to be able to learn from those interactions. They obviously got some software at work there.
Well, it depends what you mean by pre-wiring. I mean, the babies look like they have a definition of what a social interaction needs to include, and that definition changes radically over the first few years. At first, it really does seem to be timing-based. Things that respond contingently on my actions, I'm going to pay a lot of attention to. As they get older, they go through a process, we call it learning how to learn. They figure out that, you know, this coffee cup or some inanimate object isn't going to respond when I vocalize. It's going to be another person. And they'll start tuning their sounds, the direction of their sounds, where they're looking when they produce sounds, to other people. And so it's a gradual emergence of using sounds in social interactions that we see over the first couple of years.
And this is universal. This is true for every baby in every culture.
There's a lot of timing differences. So far, many of the major language groups have been looked at in terms of vocal development. And it really does look like in different cultures, though not everybody may address babies the same way, people react contingently to early sounds. What's really wild is that in my lab, a lot of parents will tell me that they don't react to their babies. They don't use baby talk. They don't do any of that stuff. And I just video and audio recorded them for an hour doing exactly that. So what that tells us is we really need to understand the parents, because it's happening at a pretty deep level.
Okay, we're going to play a clip here to kind of show what you're talking about. This is a conversation between a mother and a nine-month-old infant. Would you mind setting this up just like you do on late-night television?
Sure. So this is actually a conversation between a mother and a pre-recorded baby. There's no baby in the room that she's having this conversation with. It's part of an experiment in which we look at people's propensities to react to infant sounds. And in this particular study, they react simply by talking back to this monitor that's got a baby on it. And the way they react changes what the baby on the monitor does next.
What did you say? Dad. You want to reach the ball? Yeah, it's rolling. Do you want me to grab the ball?
So what's happening there is, even though that baby is artificial, it's a pre-recorded baby, this mom doesn't know that baby, she's reacting very contingently to those babbling sounds. And she's reacting with simplified attention-getting speech that we know is crucial for infant learning, especially if it happens right after a babble.
So moms and dads actually adapt to the child. They change their stimulus to get a response or a specific reaction from the infant.
Yeah, the reality is it's a two-way street. Babies, especially once they're past 5 months, are vocalizing in ways that get social reactions. And as that's occurring, parents are structuring their interactions around the babies in ways to get the babies to notice that they're reacting. That leads to infants learning new kinds of speech sounds. And in the study that you just played a clip from, the more advanced speech sounds, so the difference between and ababa, okay, that's data in my lab. The difference between the acoustic difference between that immature and that mature sound is what's driving parental responsiveness. They'll respond more to the more mature sounds. So you've got a feedback loop that's happening over the first year.
We have another question from the audience.
I'm Becky from Endwell. I was wondering if you, since we've been talking about early childhood development and child care centers and things like that, have you noticed any ratio between feedback with the child and a number of children ratio to adults, and how important that ratio might be?
This is something we're really interested in, getting outside the laboratory into home environments and into daycare kinds of environments. We know that a mark of a high quality daycare or preschool is a low number of caregivers to infants. I'm sorry, a low number of infants to caregivers, that's what I mean. You want that ratio to be favorable, so you're getting a lot of time for age-appropriate interaction. And so it would be really interesting to do these kinds of studies on caregivers to see if they respond like parents do, and also on infants that are in those kinds of contexts.
So does it also, it's also important for other children to be there, so they give good feedback, other children, not just adults?
That's a really good question. We don't know nearly as much about the role of siblings and older children in responding to infant behavior as we do about parents. In fact, we don't know even that much about dads as compared to moms. And one of the things we're working on right now, we have a study going on in the lab, is looking at how older siblings change their speech when they're around their infant siblings. They start doing the kind of infant-directed speech that, you know, we associate with being a parent. You know, what are you doing? Hi. You know, stuff like that. Slowing down your speech, making it more sing-song, focusing it on, you know, objects the babies are looking at. But they seem to do that really gradually and slowly. So that's one thing we're working on.
And to follow up on that, so sound matters in some cases more than grammar does.
Yes, especially in the first year. Baby's job in the first year is to figure out what sounds go with what other sounds in the language, and you need to know that because you have to know where words start and stop. Once you figure out what sounds tend to follow what other sounds, when mom says, look at the ball, you hear those as individual words instead of one big smear of sound. Because the pauses in between the words that you're hearing right now are more or less psychological. You're imposing those pauses on a continuous speech stream because you know what sounds follow other sounds. So that's what's going on in the first year. As we get into the second year, that's where the simplifications in the grammar of our speech really matters. So we don't tend to do things like, you know, read the tax code to a baby or read a complaint or talk like I'm talking right now. Babies don't have to learn adult language. They have to learn simplified speech.
Another thing, it goes without saying, is that it's a good thing that babies are small, because being small actually does help them with their language skills. Why is that?
So it's often, okay, we're immature, we're really slow developing. It's often thought that those are deficits, that that means we're incomplete as a baby. It actually confers really strong advantages when you need to learn a lot from the people around you. So for example, work by Linda Smith and Chen Yu at Indiana University has shown that having short arms enhances word learning. Okay, they like to say short arms are a feature, not a bug. Here's why. If you're in front of a table with a bunch of objects and someone says gava guy, some word you don't know, to a bunch of objects you don't know, it's hard for you to figure out what goes with what. However, if your arm's only this long, you know, think toddler here, think, you know, a foot and a half, and mom says gava guy when you're to the thing that you're holding, this takes up 30% of your visual field. You can't hold it far away from you because you have short arms. Turns out, moms that have babies that learn quickly tend to label objects that they're holding. Babies tend to watch mom's hands, and they tend to watch objects in their own hands. And so being small, being immature, can facilitate learning when you're in a social context that's responsive the right way.
We have time for one quick question from the audience.
Hi, my name is Carol, and I'm from Endicott. I'm just curious, have you found a big difference in parents that speak baby talk to infants versus parents that speak adult language to infants as to how quickly the children learn?
Most parents who say they don't do it actually do it, for starters. So I don't think there's been direct comparisons. Here's one example, though. Peter Kaplan at University of Colorado at Denver has looked at the infant-directed speech of depressed mothers versus the infant-directed speech of non-depressed mothers. So a depressed mother, instead of going, look at the cup, might say, you know, look at the cup. Little bit of inflection, not much. Those babies will not learn from their own mother's speech, though they will learn from the speech of a non-depressed mother at 4 months. By the time those babies are 13 months, they won't learn from any female. They've generalized the irrelevance of their own mother's lack of inflection. They will learn from male infant-directed speech. So the way we talk to these babies really does matter for learning.
How, there's a lot of attention paid to talking to a child so that you build a child's vocabulary. What's the best way to help a child develop a larger dictionary in his or her head?
Watch the eyes. Of all things. So, two things really. One is timing and one is focus of attention. So a lot of our work has shown that reacting contingently to their immature sounds matters for learning, but we also know that labeling things that they're looking at matters for learning too. It's called following in on attention. And so if you have a bunch of objects in front of you that you don't know the names for, that's what babies and toddlers view the world as every day. If you label something they're not looking at, you're going to cause sort of a crisscross labeling situation where they're going to learn the wrong names for the wrong things. And that can actually slow learning down. You want to see what they're looking at, talk about what they're focused on, let them lead that interaction, and we've shown that that facilitates learning.
It's got to be conversation.
You got it.
Okay. Michael, thank you so much for coming to SUNY Broome to talk with us. This has been a fascinating conversation. Once again, I wish we had more time.
Thanks.
Michael Goldstein is a psychology professor at Cornell University and directs Cornell's Baby Lab. We'll be right back with an Educators Roundtable. Stay tuned. This is Community Conversation.
Thank you.
Have you ever wondered what the future will look like?
Genomics will ultimately cure cancer.
I like to call this body 3.0.
You'll buy GPS dots in bulk.
Spare living parts fully integrate back into the body.
Generations after us say how ridiculous it was that humans were driving cars.
I'm Guy Raz. Join me each week as we look into the future on the TED Radio Hour from NPR.
Thursdays at 1 and 7 on WSKG. Think about your daily listening. Morning Edition and All Things Considered. Performance Today and Classical Music with Bill Snyder. WSKG is your source for all these quality programs. New donors are vital for WSKG's continued growth. If you're not yet a supporter of WSKG, make a difference today with your donation.
The spring fundraiser starts April 23rd, but you'll be entered to win an iPad Air when you contribute early at WSKG.org.
All right, what we would like is for you to tell us what you'd like to get out of Daddy Daycare.
Help us to help you.
Okay, now who'd like to start?
We need more learning about things.
More learning about things?
Yes. We're at a very critical age. You have to feed our minds.
Okay, all right. You want to write that down, Marvin?
Feed our minds. Great. Okay, what else?
Welcome back to Community Conversation on WSKG. I'm Charles Compton. That was a clip from Eddie Murphy's movie, Daddy Daycare. Feed minds indeed. Now with me are three mind feeders. We have Lisa Strahle, who heads the Teacher Education and Early Childhood Education Department here at SUNY Broome. Lisa, thank you so much for hosting us here.
Thank you.
Also here is Stacy Paradiso. She's a universal pre-K teacher at Binghamton University's campus pre-K. Hello to you. And also hi to Heather McShane, who's an early childhood education student at SUNY Oneonta. Welcome to you, Heather.
Thank you.
We're gonna go ahead and start with Stacy, at least with this first question. I think it's safe to say that you all have a passion for this kind of work, and I wanna ask each of you to tell me why is it pre-K that you've chosen? Why early childhood education? Why is this field for you? Again, Stacy, let's start with you.
For me, I have found that pre-K is just so much fun. Like, I've never had as much fun with an age group as I do with pre-K. They're always asking questions. They always want to know things. They always want to get into things. And it's just, I feel like we never stop, but at the same time, I never want the day to be over because it is. It's just so enriching and so much fun with pre-K.
Now, Heather, you're a student right now. Why did you choose this field?
Well, I've always had a passion with working for children since I was a little girl. Since I was like 12 years old, I've always been a camp counselor. So I've always wanted to work with children. I have three little daughters of my own, so I know how important it is for them to have a good quality childcare person for them to go to. So I've just always wanted to pursue a career in childcare.
And Lisa, you're teaching teachers. Why do you do this work?
Well, I think I would echo what Heather and Stacy say. I love what I do. And I was actually a teacher in a public school for 12 years, which I really enjoyed. But when I had the opportunity to teach others to be teachers, it was just the right place for me to be.
Am I right in saying that we're looking at a potential shortage, though, of these teachers, even though it is very rewarding work?
Yes, we are.
Why is that?
Because it's hard work, and some of the things that Donna Lopardo alluded to, it's not high pay. And, you know, I think sometimes the challenges that children have in their lives make it a difficult place to be. We love children, but our hearts break sometimes every day because we know they're struggling with life circumstances.
And I guess there are even fewer employment opportunities. I understand centers are closing because so many folks can't afford the price of quality childcare.
Yeah, and that's a good point as well. The need is there. The demand for quality childcare is high, but it's a costly organization to run, operation to run. And so to do it right, centers need support.
Heather and Stacy, we want to move on to the nuts and bolts here of teaching. But first, do you worry about these centers closing or about low wages? Let's start with you, Stacy.
I do. I mean, I see every day we struggle with low enrollment, which means one of us might not have a job next year. And it's frustrating because we don't want to stop doing what we're doing. But if we can't fill classrooms, we might have to.
What about you, Heather?
For me, I would like to open up my own childcare center, an in-home center. I know there's a high demand for it. In my area, we have nothing. No, we have not one center where I live. The one we did have closed a few years ago. And I'm not doing this to become a millionaire. I'm doing it because I love children and I love working with them.
But you're really adding to the complexity of what you're going to be doing. Probably one of the hardest jobs is to raise a child. I've done it twice.
Yeah.
As well. And you're going to be helping with it. And then you're going to run a business. Mm-hmm. On the side, and you got to turn a profit as
right.
well. I mean, That's quite a goal for yourself. What are you doing to make that happen?
It's been a long-term goal. I've been going to I'm going to be 30 next month. I've been going to college for a few years. It's taken some time. My children are young. They're 8, 6, and 4. So it's been a long journey, and I just keep going for that goal.
Have either one of you thought about maybe teaching at a public school, maybe kindergarten or older? It probably would be more rewarding and maybe a little bit more structured.
I mean, I have thought about it, but then I come into my classroom the next day and I see the children light up when we do something so so commonplace as, well, let's see what happens if we put a Skittle in water. And they're, oh my goodness, what just happened? Mm-hmm. When the color comes off and the S floats to the top. And then I think, you know, I don't anymore, because I don't think that this could happen in a public school with a classroom of 20, 25. And then I hear things like, Miss Stacy, you look like a princess today. And to just to be able to hear that and to be able to have them respond to you in the way that they do at pre-K, I don't think would happen as much in a public school when you're focused more on, you know, now it's math time. Well, we can't talk about that. Now it's math time. Or now we have to sit down and do this worksheet. And it's...
Lisa, does that leave you envious?
No, because I was actually going to say it does happen in public school. If you're meant to be a teacher, I think any age that you work with, you would find that passion. It happens with me, with my college students, and some of them are older than me. And yes, they tell me I look like a princess. But when you have the opportunity to teach somebody something and that light goes on, it doesn't matter if they're 2 months old or 98 years old, that feeling is in you.
Heather, any thoughts about public school?
I will have my teacher certification when I'm done with college, and I'm not completely against teaching in a public school. I love public school. I substitute teach in my spare time. I do substitute teach. I love the schools my children go to. My ideal age to work with is birth to 5 years of age.
And this is Community Conversation on WSKG. I'm Charles Compton. This show comes to you from the campus of SUNY Broome. If you're in the audience today and you'd like to ask a question, make your way up to the microphone. I'm talking with Lisa Straley of SUNY Broome, Stacy Paradiso of Binghamton University's campus pre-K, and Heather McShane, who's an early childhood education student at SUNY Oneonta. Stacy, you go to work every day, you teach universal pre-kindergarten. You know, how do you strategize? How do you plan the day? Let's say you got my granddaughter there when she finally arrives. You know, how are you going to get her from point A to point B?
I mean, I think it's really, for me at least, I look at where the child is when they come to me, and then I think about where I personally want them to be by the end of the year and where kindergarten says they need to be by the end of the year. And then I just take it day by day, see what opportunities lend themselves to a learning experience throughout the day. It could be having a conversation at lunchtime and learning how to have a two-sided conversation, or it could be a sit-down, let's have a math time where we work on number recognition and forming numbers and count, you know, one-to-one correspondence when we're counting.
Heather, think about your answer to that question, but first we got a question from the audience.
Yes, this is Deborah from Vestal, and I've been in the field for over 20 years, and I'm just listening to the conversation here, and I think it's really important to point out that it is so sad to hear people have to make a choice between, do I want to work with young children or older children, and that this is a decision for them on an economic basis, not necessarily where your desire and passion lies. And I think that's such an important element to make sure that we are thinking about. And I go back to when Donna was speaking earlier, and we really need to think, what long-term plan does New York State have to make sure that children in the entire pipeline have those teachers who have the greatest passion for their particular age in their classroom working with them every day?
I'm going to turn that back around on you. What can people like you do to make this choice not necessary? What can the individual do here? Any thoughts?
Well, as a director of a child care center for over 20 years, I work very much with different organizations within our state, local associations, to try to bring attention to this very matter and to encourage and mentor teachers who are coming into the field.
Panelists, what's your reaction to what she says?
I absolutely agree with you. And one of the most difficult challenges we have is attracting the right people. And I think we could spend some time talking about who the right people are for this field, but, and then retaining them. And, you know, when I hear the energy that's being spoken here, a lot of our teachers burn out. And so they come into it enthused, but it just doesn't sustain them economically, and they choose something different. And so it's a great discussion that, you know, I think we need the conversation with our legislators, because that's the kind of support that we have to have, is putting the money behind the profession.
Thanks, Lisa. So Stacey, how do you protect yourself? Heather, how do you protect yourself from burnout? Go ahead.
I think I'm a unique animal, and I have a lot of energy, and I do understand feeling burnt out and feeling, but at the end, and I just love coming to work every day, and no matter what stress goes on with the building or other teachers or the center, if I am having a good time with the children in my classroom, that's like the only energy I need. And like I said, I'm probably very unique in feeling that, as it just recharges me. We have so much fun, and we can go on, and no matter what else is going on in my life, like I could have had a fight with my husband before I came to work, I come into work and it's gone.
So you just get energy out of the kids.
Yes.
Kind of like a vampire, huh?
Not exactly.
Heather, how do you protect yourself?
I feel the same way. When I was younger as a camp counselor, and I was 14 years old in my summer break, and I'm getting up to go work with kids at 7:30, I was excited to go there at 7:30 in the morning on my summer vacation. Right now I'm helping out a mom, and she brings her kids to me at 5:00 in the morning, and I'm not a morning person, but I'm so happy when they get to my house every morning. And the requirements to become a teacher aren't easy. This morning I was going over my graduation requirements, and they added some more things on, and I was so frustrated, but I know this is something that I need to do for me and for my children. I'm a single mother, so for them to see, you know, me almost done and get over the things that I've done, it's a great achievement.
I'm sorry, I want to drill into that a little bit. So they changed the requirements that are expected from you and you're nearing graduation?
I have like one semester left of classes, and then a block semester in student teaching, and I need to take pre-calculus. And I thought that my math like prereqs were done, and I am missing a class, so I have to like take an extra class to be able to be on block and then graduation.
And does that sort of thing happen a lot, Lisa, where we have changing expectations of our students?
They do, but usually it's for the incoming class, so. Yeah, I can't really speak to
sure.
that.
Sure, yeah, I'm just wondering, because it sounds like it's an evolving field all the time, where the expectations and the regulations are changing, and so in some sense, folks like you are shooting at a moving target while
Trust
riding
me, because
a horse.
I was just talking about this, you need 122 credits for a bachelor's, and I have like 165 right now, and I'm not even done yet.
I want to get back to that question I put off earlier, Heather, about strategizing for your day. Mm-hmm. How do you structure or strategize a day for your young students?
For my young students? Well, I don't have students yet, but when I do, even for my children, for a day in the summer, just like she said, you can take any moment and make it a teachable moment, and you can learn, and I feel like you can't really have a set curriculum with small children. You kind of just have to go. You can have ideas of what they need to learn, but you just kind of got to go with the flow and see what they're interested in. If we go for a walk and they find some animals in a stream, mm-hmm. let's find out what they are. Let's let them get wet and dirty and learn on their own.
Lisa, how do you go about setting goals for any specific child?
Well, you know, I think that there has to be that intentionality of what you hope to achieve with a child. And, although you want to follow the child's lead, and certainly those teachable moments are always going to happen, there does have to be a structured understanding of what you're attaining and how you're observing the child to make sure that growth is happening in all of those domains.
I remember when my youngest daughter started reading, I was bragging on her because she could read. She was like 2 years old. But, I mean, that's really not as important, is it, in a young child's development. Is letters and numbers. When should that sort of thing become important to a child?
I think it's absolutely critical from the very beginning.
Okay.
And I think it starts with loving, nurturing families and care providers who read to their children and have that experience of the emotional connection and social connection with books. And just being read to creates a lot of stimulation within the brain that sets them up for success for the rest of their lives. And math is the same way. You're never too young to count whatever you're doing with a child. Mm-hmm. You know, as you're going up the stairs or whatever's in front of them, the lunch, the peas on the plate. So numbers are relevant in a very real sense, just like letters are, that it's through their experiences and a lot of times following their lead, but they should be exposed to that all the time.
Mm-hmm. Stacy over there nodding vigorously.
Yes. I absolutely agree with Lisa, and I think that part of it goes with what you were doing also, is bragging on them big time. When they're making a stride or that they're showing a love for letters or numbers, you make a big deal out of it and you show them how excited you get about it. In my classroom right now, we're working on getting them to know what the difference between what we call readers and what we call rememberers. And we tell them that a reader looks at the words when they say what it says. They might not be at the point where they are reading what it says, but it's something familiar to them, like the stop sign or the wet floor sign. And if they're looking at it and they are saying, oh, that says wet floor, even if they don't really know that the two words wet and floor, but they've recognized the sign, and we make a big deal, oh my goodness, you're being a reader, you looked at the words and you told me what that said, and you make a big deal out of it, and that fosters something mm-hmm. in them that says, she just got so excited about what I just did. I'm gonna do that again, and I'm gonna do it again and again and again because I love the reaction I just got from my teacher.
I was watching educational TV with one of my nephews not too long ago, and I was watching some show with them. I was bored to tears. And they were talking about shapes and structures and seeing groups like one of these things just doesn't belong like they did on Sesame Street. I mean, that's increasingly important too, not just letters and numbers, is it?
Oh, absolutely. Although most effective is when they're real objects that children have the opportunities to explore.
Oh, so instead of watching the TV, you put the box and I was doing the best I could.
Another point I wanted to make to that, though, is when we talk about the importance and the critical nature of early literacy, is that when we know children who are read to come to kindergarten having heard 30 million more words than children who have not been read to. And so when you try to picture now that they're in public school and kindergarten, it's tough to close that gap. So that's the importance of the work that we're doing here with that birth through age 5.
What is the ratio between work and play here with a child? I mean it's, I'm hoping there's time for play.
If you're good at what you do, it's all play and it's all work. They don't know they're working.
Well, explain that to me. How do you strike that balance? Let's go to Heather. We haven't heard from you for a while. I mean, how do you make work into play?
Well, even if they're having snack and you're doing Skittles and you're sorting the colors and you're making them in rows and, you know, you're putting all the purples and all the greens, that's math right there, and they're excited because they're going to get to eat those Skittles after, but you know that they're learning how to sort and they're learning how to count each of the Skittles before they eat them.
Stacy, can you give me other examples of that kind of thing?
Before I came here today, we were talking about hummingbirds, and we took a straw and we put tape on the end of it talking about how hummingbirds have a really, really long sticky tongue and their really, really long beak, and that's how they get the nectar from the flower. And they took the straw and with the tape on the end, and they went over to this pretend flower that had confetti in the middle that was pretend nectar, and they're sticking their hummingbird beak in. They don't know that they're learning about hummingbirds. They're just having fun using sticky things in a straw.
Nice. Has Common Core stuck its head into what you're doing with early childhood education as well? Is Common Core shaping what's going on at the 3-year-old level?
Yes.
Before, how so?
Well, it's in pre-K mm-hmm. at this point, and you know it drives teacher assessment, and it's the standards. So a lot of times what they're talking about is the push down standards. So kindergarten is now what first grade used to be, first mm-hmm. grade, you know, and so there's a lot of pressure on these teachers in pre-K to get kids kindergarten ready. And sometimes that means that they're not presenting material in a way that's actually beneficial to learning.
So it can be counter
productive. Yes, it can be.
And so you're working your way through that? I mean, is that widely recognized as being a problem, or is that something that people are just now noticing?
Well, from my perspective, it's really important for us to prepare teachers to understand the core and to know how to present developmentally appropriate ways of still teaching children rather than just teaching to an assessment that's going to be rolled out down the road.
So we're still figuring it out.
Oh, we'll never be done figuring it out. When we do figure it out, it'll change.
We have another question from the audience.
Hi, my name is Jerry from Jackson City. This is such a huge, huge issue. And I guess my question is, we hear about a lack of childcare slots. We hear about a shortage of teachers. We hear about a shortage of early childhood education centers. We hear about teacher pay. Where do we begin?
Any speculation on where we need to begin?
I wish I knew.
Jerry, do you have any ideas?
I don't. This is, I mean, like boiling the ocean. When we talk about this as a community, there are so many pieces of this, but what is it that you think we can start to do? Is there, you know, teacher pay is a big mm-hmm. issue from what I understand, that as soon as you have the opportunity, except for you three, as soon as you have the opportunity to move into the public school system and double your salary, you know, you go. Mm-hmm. We have families that can't afford childcare because it's so expensive. Mm-hmm. I mean, it just, it's one thing after another, and I think a lot of us are looking for, what is that starting point? What is the catalyst that can get this moving so that we can begin to improve the childhood education mm-hmm. in our community.
Thanks, Jerry. You know, something I want to follow up on as well is what was the hardest thing for you guys to learn as you prepare yourself for taking care of little kids?
And Heather touched on it earlier. I am 100% type A control freak. I came into this field with, this is my plan, it must be this way. That doesn't happen when you work with young children. And I've kind of grown to learn that go with the flow is the name of the game. If you start the day off thinking you're going to talk about bugs and you go outside and a child finds some really interesting thing with the tree and they want to talk about that and that's all they can focus on, you're going to go with what they're talking about and then you're going to throw your plan out the window and see what you can do with what they're interested in. Because if they're interested in something completely different, your control freak type A plan that I want to stick to isn't going to be as meaningful because they're still focused on the other thing.
Heather, how has your in-classroom training affected your parenting?
A lot. I mean, I've been going to school since I was pregnant for my first child. And the things I do at home, you know, you always are thinking about positive reinforcement than saying, no, don't do that. You know, there's in, you know, redirecting and there's so many things. And I, to touch on what the question that here, the response that he had, I mean, you can't think you're going to be a childcare educator and be a millionaire. You just, you're not out there to make millions of dollars. And I feel like it's putting, the Common Core is putting a pressure on childcare providers who do work on the with the children that are birth to five because they need so much more quality care before they go to pre-K because there's so many more requirements now. It can't be just quote-unquote babysitting and you're sitting on a floor while they're, you know, playing in a completely different area. You really need to work with the children and get them ready to go to pre-K.
Lisa, any final thoughts?
Well, yeah, you know, I think that rhetoric, though, is troubling to me, that because we are good at what we do, but because it's working with children, we should accept that we're not going to have a high quality of life with salaries. And I think we need to stop accepting that and raise the level of the profession, like Assemblywoman Lopardo talked about. And also, when we, you know, to address your question, Assemblywoman Lopardo did talk about it, that we need to have conversations with the community. This has to be talked about. And we have to fully understand that what we invest 0 to 5 pays off fivefold in our community. It reduces the imprisonment rates. It reduces high school dropouts. It creates citizens who are able to think and communicate and participate. And so that's what it's going to take. I think we really need to invest in those young ones.
I'm sorry to cut you off, but we really do appreciate a big thank you to everyone who's here at SUNY Broome helping put the show together here, especially to Lisa Straley, Sylvia Briga, and Furman Romero. Thanks also to WSKG's Jackie Stapleton, Nancy Coddington, Eric Jensen, Solveig Wastvedt, and Brian Sikora. Ryan Kalesa and Eric Adler engineered this show. Our director and producer was Brett Jaspers. Thanks for listening. I'm Charles Compton.